Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. Secretary of State heads to Capitol Hill to publicly defend the Iran nuclear pact. Some new developments in the race for the White House. We look at the work of a novelist who mixed fiction and fact. And a divorce saddens the world of country music.
Say It Ain't So. I mean, they seem like the perfect couple. They're winning awards together. They've written songs together. They've written songs for other people. Just, they've always tweeted about their love for each other. So it came as a total surprise.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. The first public testimony by the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear agreement takes place today before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, since the deal was reached in Vienna July 14th. Secretary of State John Kerry, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, and Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz will answer lawmakers' questions. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Well, as he briefed members of both the Senate and House of Representatives Wednesday, Mr. Kerry said he looks forward to answering any and all questions lawmakers have about the pact, which is under a congressional 60-day review period.
We are convinced that the agreement that we have arrived at with world powers is an agreement that will prevent Iran from the potential of securing a nuclear weapon. It will make the region, our friends and allies, safer. It will make the world safer. And we are convinced that the absence of any viable alternative absolutely underscores that fact.
But some lawmakers, including members of the Republican majority in both houses, have indicated they will do what they can to defeat the measure. Senator Tom Cotton says supporters will need 34 votes in the Senate and 146 in the House to win.
Well, I think the vote count itself clearly indicates that there's not a one-third plus one minority to sustain a presidential veto yet. Perhaps they'll get there, but the longer this deal is reviewed by the American people and they learn details like Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard Corps getting sanctions relief for the fact that it may take at least 24 days, if not weeks, to get access to disputed sites, I think the American people are going to weigh in and Congress is going to reflect their opinion and that we're going to kill this deal.
Another Senate Republican, Lindsey Graham, who's running for president, says a better agreement awaits the world with the election in 2016 of a new president, and called the current deal the best the Obama administration could get because, in his words, the president is weak in the eyes of our enemies and unreliable in the eyes of our friends. In Saudi Arabia Wednesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said he secured Saudi support for the deal with reservations about verification and the future of sanctions. Saudi Arabia, a regional rival of Tehran, has made no public pronouncements about the agreement since it was signed. RAND Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan told me Riyadh is taking the long view on its security relationship with the U.S.
The security relationship with the United States is critical, not only for the security of Saudi Arabia, but also for the entire Gulf area. And so while Carter came out and said that the Saudis approved the Iran nuclear deal, I think it was more along the lines that they didn't voice any strong objections to their concerns over the international inspectors to verify that Iran was complying with the deal and if it wasn't to be able to snap back the provisions. Given the way that the Arab culture is and the way they deal with U.S. diplomats in that region, it doesn't surprise me that they didn't come out very strongly opposing a deal that the United States had already entered. It would be counterproductive for them to do so.
How likely is a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, given this deal?
I think the nuclear arms race has already begun. This will likely give the Saudis incentives to continue. There have been ample news reports of the Saudis already dealing with the Pakistanis to counter this effect. So I think we're going to see a real potential in the future if Iran starts cheating on this deal, which most observers believe they probably will, that over the objections of the United States, the Saudis will probably start to try to find other ways to provide their security to protect them in the event that the Iranians develop a breakthrough capacity in the next several years.
Rick, of course, the debate in Congress on the nuclear deal is already underway. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, Wednesday expressed deep skepticism, saying, quote, because a bad deal threatens the security of the American people, we're going to do everything possible to stop it. Even though Republicans control both houses of Congress, isn't this really a matter of how many Democrats will vote with and against the president?
It's even worse than that, because even if the United States Congress gets sufficient number of votes on the Democratic side, the president has already gone to the U.N. Security Council, which unanimously supported the deal. So for all intents and purposes, going to Congress at this point is little more than going through the motions of asking for congressional support. The agreement's been signed. The Security Council's approved it, and as long as the Iranians continue to march down the road and fulfill their short-term agreements within the next 90 days, this is going to be in place as international law and international policy, regardless of what the U.S. Congress says.
And Britain says he agrees with Iran's spiritual leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who says Iran and American interests in the Middle East are poles apart. Brennan says what many American policymakers in both major parties fail to realize is that Iran, since the creation of the Islamic Republic in 1979, has been at war with the U.S. and has been indirectly responsible for thousands of American casualties.
Thank you for that report, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what do you have?
Well, we're anticipating President Obama's trip to Kenya and Ethiopia coming up. He's leaving tonight to go over to Africa.
His father's homeland.
His father's homeland, exactly. And CNN is covering the trip, of course, as many news organizations are, but they're in a bit of hot water with a lot of Kenyans. Last night they were talking about the trip, and they said that President Obama's heading to a hotbed of terror activity.
Ooh.
Well, this set off a social media firestorm, and the hashtag, someone tell CNN, a lot of Kenyans weighing in saying, someone tell CNN this isn't a hotbed of terror activity. A lot of people posting beautiful pictures of Kenya saying, someone tell CNN this is not the hotbed that they're talking about. My personal favorite that I saw was somebody posted a picture of a mattress on fire and said, someone tell CNN this is the only hotbed that I see.
Oh,
so kind of a funny play on words. But a lot of social media reaction on that, a lot of anger from Kenyans about CNN calling them a hotbed of terror activity, saying we have nothing but love and good hopes for President Obama on his trip.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you stopping by.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chicago have found evidence that becoming a father can make you fat. Research from Northwestern University also finds that it doesn't matter if new fathers live with their children or not. The researchers kept track of the weight of more than 10,000 men from the time when the men were adolescents until young adulthood. They found that a nearly 2 meter tall man who lives with his child gained an average of about 2 kilograms and had a 2.6% rise in his body mass index after becoming a first-time dad. Similar new fathers not living with their child gained about 1.5 kilograms and had a 2% increase in their BMI. On the other hand, a nearly 2 meter tall man who was not a father actually lost 635 grams over the same period. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Governor John Kasich, a political veteran, has joined the very, very, very crowded field seeking the 2016 U.S. Republican presidential nomination. And VOA national correspondent Jim Malone's always got an eye on what's going on here in the States with this. Jim, what can you tell us about this fellow?
Hey, Susan, he's an interesting guy. He is now in his second term as governor of Ohio, which is one of the most important states in our presidential election process. Usually, whichever candidate wins Ohio wins the White House. Kasich has an interesting background in terms of being a Republican budget cutter, but also one who, as governor, has reached out to minority communities and the poor, trying to help them with health care and education. Hey, I covered this guy 20 years ago when he was in the House of Representatives, and he has a reputation as a straight shooter. Sometimes it gets him into trouble because he's so off the cuff. But he could offer a kind of refreshing type of Republican, compassionate conservative if he can fit into the Republican field. And as you mentioned, he's number 16 and counting. So he's got to make up some time here to try to get noticed and to bump up in the polls.
And meanwhile, he's being overshadowed in the media by Trump.
Yeah, he and everybody else right now. Donald Trump continues to run his sort of political circus around the country. He's getting a lot of attention. His most recent rally in South Carolina, he went off on the attack on people like Rick Perry, Lindsey Graham, a senator from South Carolina, calling them names. This is going to get kind of ugly and nasty, and it all heads toward the first Republican debate on August 6th, when, by all standards right now, it looks as though Donald Trump will be in that. Only the top 10 of the 16 will make it based on polls in the debate. So everyone is now focused on that first event as the kind of the first time we'll get to sort of sort out among these so many Republican contenders.
You think people are really going to take Trump seriously when it comes to casting that ballot?
Good question. I think, you know, there's a lot of media hype around him right now. He likes to go on the attack, makes some people uncomfortable. He's obviously tapped into something, though. There is kind of an anger there among some of the conservative Republicans about things like illegal immigration and the direction of the country. I think the Republican rivals see that. They want to be able to appeal to that voting group. But right now, Trump has their ear. The question is, in the debate, for example, will people start to go after Donald Trump? And certainly after his most recent attacks on some of his rivals, it looks like this Republican race is only going to get more heated.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to it. Thanks, Jim.
You bet.
Coming up on International Edition, a novelist is remembered for his special style, and music fans are surprised by announcement of a divorce. A new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease, which affects the brain and is eventually fatal, has been announced by drug manufacturer Eli Lilly and Company. International Edition's Jeffrey Young joins us now. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Hey, Jeffrey, you spoke to one of Eli Lilly's top research doctors. What did he have to say?
Yes, Dr. Eric Siemers at Lilly, who's closely involved with the trials of this new drug, solanezumab, told me what the research shows and how this drug has promise in the fight against this disease.
We have a drug, the name of which is solanezumab, that's currently in clinical trials, and we have generated what we think are some fairly promising results from those clinical trials. We presented results in late 2012 from studies that were called the Expedition and Expedition 2 studies, and now we have some additional data from people who finished the Expedition studies but then continued to receive the medication solanezumab. And so these additional data that we've found, we think really add to the promise that we first found at the end of 2012.
Up until now, have there been any drugs that were effective in treating Alzheimer's?
There are medications that are currently available that have a modest effect on the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. But what we don't have are any kind of treatments that get at what we think is the underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease. In other words, the reason why brain cells die with this disorder. For solanezumab, based on the way it works, we think we're getting at the underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease.
It has been said numerous times that because of the size of the baby boomer population and worldwide, the number of people who are entering their 50s and their 60s, et cetera, that Alzheimer's is a growing and growing problem. Can you give me some illustration of how big a problem Alzheimer's is?
Well, as you say, it's a big problem now, and the problem will become huge if we don't do something about it. Currently in the United States, there's over 5 million people with Alzheimer's. Worldwide, there's over 30 million people with Alzheimer's disease. Those numbers will likely triple by the year 2050 if we don't find a way to delay the onset or even prevent the disease.
That was Dr. Eric Siemers at drug manufacturer Eli Lilly and Company, which has a new drug to fight early stages of Alzheimer's disease.
This may hold some hope for people. It's good news.
Alzheimer's is a huge problem worldwide. Let's hope this new development helps.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Susan.
You're tuned to VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A robotic bricklayer that its inventor says can place 1,000 bricks an hour. It's called Hadrian, yes, for the wall, and it's a big mobile platform stacked with bricks next to a huge cantilevered hydraulic arm that sprouts from the center of the platform, able to stretch a distance of 8.5 meters. Hadrian can work 24 hours a day, squirting mortar on bricks and placing them fast enough to build a moderately sized house every 2 days, or about 150 houses a year. This high-tech bricklayer, designed in Australia for a company called Fast Bricks Robotics, uses 3D designs of houses to program where all the bricks go before cutting and placing each of them. And the reach of the robotic arm means Hadrian doesn't have to be moved that often. The company says if Hadrian goes from a prototype to a commercially viable machine, the days of hand trowels and mortar-caked overalls may be over. I'm Todd Grosshans for VOA's What's New.
The world recently learned of the death of novelist E.L. Doctorow at the age of 84. He was lauded for his reimagining of historical events, usually experienced through the eyes of interesting fictional characters and some characters who actually lived. International Edition's Adam Phillips is in New York, where Doctorow maintained a home, and he is on the line with us now to talk a little bit about the literary lion. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Susan.
Why was this particular novelist just so important?
Well, he really invented a genre, sort of. He reimagined historical events through the eyes of these amazing characters that really, really made the reader feel like you knew them and you were actually there. And he interspersed it, interestingly, with actual historical characters. For example, in Ragtime, which he's most famous for, you meet, you know, Sigmund Freud, you meet Houdini, you meet all kinds of fascinating people, but you really get a feeling for what they are, well beyond the facts, which he, you know, played fast and loose with and sometimes actually got some criticism for. But he was a novelist, not an historian.
Well, what were some of the other titles?
Well, he was famous, for Ragtime. He was famous for Billy Bathgate, which was about Dutch Schultz and this boy that he hired as an errand boy when he was being put in prison almost for tax evasion. He also wrote a book called World's Fair, which is all about the 1939 World's Fair and America's entry into World War II and that whole era. And his most famous, I think, as a masterpiece was March, which was about General Sherman's march to Atlanta during the Civil War and really ended the Civil War, you know, after lots and lots of death and arson. That was really considered the climax of his career from a literary point of view.
I understand Doctorow was a real New Yorker, huh?
Yes, and New York was a character in his fiction. You could really feel like you sort of can sit down with New York and have a drink if you wanted to. He was born in the Bronx. He grew up in sort of the post-war era where there were lots of fascinating and brilliant emigres who had fled Europe during World War II. He actually got his literary start writing a story about a Carnegie Hall stage doorman that was going to be printed in his high school newspaper, but it turned out to be false. The guy never really lived. So he was controversial then. He became controversial later on, but I think everyone would agree that he was a giant literary voice of American letters.
Well, thanks, Adam, for your insight.
Sure. Thank you, Susan.
They've won awards together, they help rescue animals together, they make beautiful music together, but now they are not together. Country musicians Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert have announced they are divorcing after 4 years of marriage. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about the breakup, which has left fans shocked and saddened.
They are country music's power couple, but now they're a couple no more. Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert are calling it quits. Nikki, this is shocking.
Oh,
this news
goodness.
Has shocked country music fans.
Yes.
It shocked music fans in general.
Yeah, just say it ain't so. I mean, they seem like the perfect couple. They're winning awards together. They've written songs together. They've written songs for other people. Just they've always tweeted about their love for each other. So it came as a total surprise. But they released a joint statement to
right.
the Associated Press, and it officially said, "This is not the future we envisioned, and it is with heavy hearts that we move forward separately. We are real people with real lives, with real families, friends, and colleagues. Therefore, we kindly ask for privacy and compassion concerning this very personal matter."
Now, there's been a bunch, I don't want to report rumor.
Sure.
But there's been a bunch of theories, let's say.
Speculation
as to why. Because, as you said, these two people always seem to have the twinkle in their eye for one another.
Yes.
And now, boom, all of a sudden, it dropped like a bomb.
Mine would be you.
There's been allegations of infidelity.
All kinds of stuff. Yes. Now, I will say, to their defense, ever since they were married, people were putting stuff out there. And they've been fighting up against that. But now that it's official, people are speculating all kinds of things. Chris Young was... Miranda has been accused of cheating on Blake twice, one with a gentleman who's not a star, and the other one is Chris Young. And even he took to Twitter, and he said, "No, I have nothing to do with this. I'm friends with both of these individuals, and I love them both." And so... it's been sad all around. The fact that people really, I really would like the press, you know, in general, to let them go ahead and heal and go through what it is that they need to go through. But people are determined to try to figure out why they broke up. And on one level, I understand it because everything seemed fine. But on another level, I think there's a lot of conjecture and a lot of lies that are being put out there. And only time will really tell. And I think after some time, when they're ready to talk about it, I think they both will be very honest and straightforward. I say listen to the music. A lot of it is in the music.
We wish them all the best. If you want to comment on this, you can send Nikki a tweet at @VOA_music. You can send one to me at @David_DBird or at @VOA_IE. And you can also listen for Nikki's show, Country Hits USA, at www.voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to human rights organizations and Chinese activists, in recent weeks, Chinese authorities have systematically detained, arrested, subjected to forced disappearance, held incommunicado, or questioned and released 169 lawyers, legal staff, and activists involved in peacefully challenging official policies in China. Chinese authorities detained lawyers from several law firms, including six from the Beijing Fengrui firm. The Fengrui law firm handled a number of high-profile human rights cases, including the case of jailed Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohati. The crackdown began on July 9th when Fengrui lawyer Wang Yu disappeared after alerting friends via a text message that her internet connection and electricity had been cut off and that people were trying to break into her home. Wang had represented several clients involved in human rights activism or religious freedom issues, including practitioners of Falun Gong, a religious group banned in China. The firm's director, Zhu Shifeng, was also detained. He had represented Zhang Miao, a Chinese journalist who'd reported on the Hong Kong democracy protests. Among those who have not been heard from since being detained is well-known lawyer Lu Heping. He represented fellow lawyer and blind activist Chen Guangcheng and helped victims of forced evictions. The United States is deeply concerned that the broad scope of China's new national security law is being used as a legal facade to commit human rights abuses. The U.S. strongly urges China to respect the rights of all its citizens and to release all those who have recently been detained for seeking to protect the rights of Chinese citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.